You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of Karmic Relationships, Esoteric Studies by Rudolf Steiner. This is the last volume in the series, Volume 8, and it is the last lecture in that volume, Lecture 6, which is chronologically Lecture 70. If we look back over the evolution of mankind since the mystery of Golgotha, we get the impression that Christianity, the Christ impulse, has only been able to live on within the European and American civilizations in the face of definite obstacles and in association with other streams of spiritual life. And a study of the growth and gradual development of Christianity reveals many remarkable facts. Today I want to describe in broad outlines the growth and development of Christianity in connection with what ought to live within the anthroposophical society, and not only ought to, but can live, because those persons who feel an honest and sincere urge toward anthroposophy have this urge from the very depths of their being. If we take the facts of repeated earthly lives in all seriousness, we shall say, this inner urge to get away from the conceptions and habits of thought of those among whom life, education, and social relationships have placed us, this urge that we feel to enter a stream of thought which really makes claims upon our life of soul, must have its origin in karma, in the karma coming from earlier lives on earth. Now, if we study the question of karma in connection with those personalities who find themselves together in the anthroposophical movement, it transpires that, without exception, before their present earthly life, they have had one other important incarnation since the mystery of Golgotha. They were already on earth once, since the time of the mystery of Golgotha, and are now there for the second time since that event. And then the great question arises, how has the previous earthly life, with respect to the mystery of Golgotha, worked upon these personalities, who now, out of their karma, feel the urge to enter the anthroposophical movement? Even from exoteric study, we find that men standing as firmly within the stream of Christianity itself as St. Augustine have said, quote, Christianity did not begin with Christ. There were Christians before Christ, only they were not so called. Close quote. This is what St. Augustine says. Those who penetrate more deeply into the spiritual mysteries of human evolution and can study these spiritual mysteries with initiation science will strongly confirm such a view as is expressed by St. Augustine. For it is a fact. But it becomes necessary, then, to know in what form that which through the mystery of Golgotha became the historical Christ impulse upon the earth existed in earlier times. Today I can speak of this earlier form of Christianity by starting from impressions which came in a place not far distant from Torquay, where our summer course has been held, in Tintagel, whence proceeded the spiritual stream connected with King Arthur. It was possible to receive the impressions which can still come today at the spot where King Arthur's castle with its round table stood, impressions which come above all from the magnificent natural surroundings of this castle. At this place where nothing but ruins remain of the old citadel of King Arthur, where we look back as if in memory across the centuries that have elapsed since the Arthur stream went out from thence, we realize how stone after stone has so crumbled away that there is hardly anything to be recognized of the old castles which once were inhabited by King Arthur and those around him. But when, with the eye of spirit, EYE, we look out from the place where the castle once stood, over the sea with its iridescent colors and breaking waves, the impression we get is that we are able at this place to penetrate deeply into the elemental secrets of nature and of the cosmos. And if we look back with occult sight, if we can visualize the point of time which lies a few thousand years ago, when the Arthur stream had its beginning, then we see that those who lived on Arthur's Mount had, as is the case with all such occult centers, chosen this spot because the impulses necessary for the tasks they had set themselves, for their mission in the world, needed the play of those forces which nature there displayed before them. I cannot say whether it is always so, but when I saw the view there was a most wonderful play of waves surging and rippling up from the depths, in itself one of the most beautiful sights in all nature. These waves hurl themselves against the walls of rock, and as they fall back again in seething foam, the elementary spirits are able to rise up from below and come to living expression. From above, the sunlight is reflected in manifold forms in the waves of the air. This interplay of elemental nature from above and from below reveals the full power of the sun and displays it in such a way that man is able to receive it into his being. Those who can imbibe what is given by this interplay of the beings born of the light above and the beings born in the depths below receive the power of the sun, the impulse of the sun. It is a moment in which man can unfold what I will call piety, piety in the pagan sense. Christian piety is not the same as pagan piety, which means inner surrender to the gods of nature, working and weaving everywhere in the play of nature. Those who lived around King Arthur absorbed this play of weaving, working nature into their very being. And most significant of all was what they were able to receive in the first centuries after the mystery of Golgotha. I want to tell you today about the character of this spiritual life that was connected with such centers as that of King Arthur's Round Table. And I must begin by speaking of something that is known to you all. When a human being dies, he leaves his physical body and still has his etheric body around him for a few days. After these few days have elapsed, he lays aside his etheric body and lives on, then, in his astral body and ego. What happens thus to the man who has passed through the gate of death appears to the eye of vision as if the etheric being were dissolving. After death, the etheric human being expands and expands, his actual form becoming more and more indefinite as he weaves himself into the cosmos. A remarkable phenomenon, and the exact opposite of this other, occurred in the world historic sense when the mystery of Golgotha took place. What was it that happened then? Up to that time, Christ had been a sun being, had belonged to the sun. Before the mystery of Golgotha had come to pass, the knights of King Arthur's Round Table stood on these rocks, gazed at the play between the sun-born spirits and the earth-born spirits, and felt that the forces living in this play of nature spirits poured into their hearts, and above all through their etheric bodies. Therewith they received into themselves the Christ impulse, which was then streaming away from the sun and was living in everything that is brought into being by the sun forces. And so, before the mystery of Golgotha, the knights of King Arthur received into themselves the sun spirit, that is to say, the Christ as he was in pre-Christian times. And they sent their messengers out into all Europe to subdue the wild savagery of the astral bodies of the peoples of Europe, to purify and to civilize, for such was their mission. We see such men as these knights of King Arthur's Round Table, starting from this point in the west of England, to bear to the peoples of Europe, as they were at that time, what they had received from the sun, purifying the astral forces of the then barbarous European population, barbarous at all events in Central and Northern Europe. Then came the mystery of Golgotha. What happened in Asia? Over yonder in Asia, the sublime Sun Being, who is later known as the Christ, left the sun. This betokened a kind of death for the Christ being. He went forth from the sun as we human beings go forth from the earth when we die. And as a man who dies leaves his physical body behind on the earth, and his etheric body, which is laid aside after 3 days, is visible to the seer, so Christ left behind him in the sun that which in my book Theosophy is called, in quotes, spirit man, the seventh member of the human being. Christ died to the sun. He died cosmically, from the sun to the earth. He came down to the earth. From the moment of Golgotha onward, his life spirit was to be seen around the earth. We ourselves leave behind at death the life ether, the etheric body, the life body. After this cosmic death, Christ left his spirit man on the sun, and around the earth his life spirit. So that after the mystery of Golgotha, the earth was swathed, as it were, by the life spirit of the Christ. Now the connections between places are not the same in the spiritual life as they are in the physical life. The life spirit of the Christ was perceived in the Irish mysteries, in the mysteries of Hibernia, and above all by the knights of King Arthur's Round Table. So up to the time of the mystery of Golgotha, the Christ impulse, belonging to the sun, actually went out from this place where the impulses were received from the sun. Afterward the power of the knights diminished, but they lived at the same time within this life spirit which encircled the earth, and in which there was this constant interplay of light and air, of the spirits in the elements from above and from below. Try to picture to yourselves the cliff with King Arthur's castle upon it, and from above the sun forces playing down in the light and air, and pouring upwards from below the elementary beings of the earth. There is a living interplay between sun and earth. In the centuries which followed the mystery of Golgotha, this all took place within the life spirit of the Christ. So that in the play of nature between sea and rock, air and light, there was revealed, as it were in spiritual light, the event of Golgotha. Understand me rightly, my dear friends. If in the first 5 centuries of our era men looked out over the sea, and had been prepared by the exercises practiced by the 12 who were around King Arthur, and who were concerned above all with the mysteries of the zodiac, if they looked out over the sea, they could see not merely the play of nature, but they could begin to read a meaning in it, just as one reads a book instead of merely staring at it. And as they looked and saw, here a gleam of light, there a curling wave, here the sun mirrored on a rocky cliff, there the sea dashing against the rocks, it all became a flowing, weaving picture, a truth whose meaning could be deciphered. And when they deciphered it, they knew of the spiritual fact of the mystery of Golgotha. The mystery of Golgotha was revealed to them because the picture was all irradiated by the life spirit of Christ presented to them by nature. Yonder in Asia the mystery of Golgotha had taken place, and its impulse had penetrated deeply into the hearts and souls of men. We need only think of those who became the first Christians to realize what a change had come about in their souls. While all this of which I have been telling you was happening in the West, the Christ himself, the Christ who had come down to earth, leaving his spirit man on the sun and his life spirit in the atmosphere around the earth, bringing down his ego and his spirit self to the earth, the Christ was moving from east to west in the hearts of men, through Greece, northern Africa, Italy, Spain, across Europe. The Christ worked here in the hearts of men, while over in the West he was working through nature. And so, on the one hand, we have the story of the mystery of Golgotha, legible in the book of nature, for those who were able to read it, working from west to east. It represented, as it were, the science of the higher graduates of King Arthur's Round Table. And on the other hand, we have a stream flowing from east to west, not in wind and wave, in air and water, not over hills or in the rays of the sun, but flowing through the blood, laying hold of the hearts of men on its course from Palestine through Greece into Italy and Spain. The one stream flows through nature, the other through the blood and the hearts of men. These two streams flow to meet one another. The pagan stream is still working, even today. It bears the pre-Christian Christ, the Christ who was proclaimed as a sun-being by those who were knights of the Round Table, but also by many others before the mystery of Golgotha actually took place. The pre-Christian Christ was carried through the world by this stream even in the age of the mystery of Golgotha. And a great deal of this wisdom was carried forth into the world by the stream known as that of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. It is possible, even today, to discover these things. There is a pagan Christianity, a Christianity that is not directly bound up with the actual historical event of Golgotha. And coming upward to meet this stream, there is the form of Christianity that is connected directly with the mystery of Golgotha, flowing through the blood, through the hearts and souls of men. Two streams come to meet one another. The pre-Christian Christ stream, etherealized, as it were, and the Christian Christ stream. The one is known subsequently as the Arthur stream, the other as the Grail stream. Later on, they came together. They came together in Europe, above all in the spiritual world. How can we describe this movement? The Christ who descended through the mystery of Golgotha drew into the hearts of men. In the hearts of men he passed from east to west, from Palestine through Greece, across Italy and Spain. The Christianity of the Grail spread through the blood and the hearts of men. The Christ took his way from east to west. And to meet him from the west, there came the spiritual, etheric image of the Christ, the image evoked by the mystery of Golgotha, but still picturing the Christ of the sun mysteries. Behind the scenes of world history, sublime and wonderful events were taking place. From the West came pagan Christianity, the Arthur Christianity, also under other names and in another form. From the East came the Christ in the hearts of men. And then the meeting takes place. The meeting between the Christ who had himself come down to earth and his own image, which is brought to him from west to east. This meeting took place in the year 869 A.D. Up to that year we have two streams, clearly distinct from one another. The one stream, more in the north, passed across central Europe and bore the Christ as a sun hero, whether the name were Baldur or some other. And under the banner of Christ, the sun hero, the knights of Arthur spread their culture abroad. The other stream, rooted inwardly in the hearts of men, which later on became the Grail stream, is to be perceived more in the south, coming from the east. It bears the real Christ, the Christ himself. The other stream brings to meet it from the west a cosmic image of the Christ. This meeting of Christ with himself, of Christ the brother of humanity, with Christ the sun hero, who is there only, as it were, in an image. This meeting of Christ with his own image took place in the 9th century. I have given you here, my dear friends, an idea of the inner happenings during the first centuries after the mystery of Golgotha, when, as I have already said, the souls were living who are now again upon earth, and who have carried with them from their previous earthly lives the urge to come in sincerity into the anthroposophical movement. Footnote, see Karmic Relationships, Volume 3. End of footnote. When we consider this significant Arthur stream from west to east, it appears to us as the stream which brings the impulse of the sun into earthly civilization. In this Arthur stream is working and weaving the Michael stream, as we may call it in Christian terminology, the stream in the spiritual life of humanity, in which we have been living since the end of the 70s of the last century. The ruling power known by the name of Gabriel, who had held sway for 3 or 4 centuries in European civilization, was succeeded at the end of the 70s of last century by Michael. And the rulership of Michael will last for 3 to 4 centuries, weaving and working in the spiritual life of mankind. And so we have good cause at the present time to speak of the Michael streams, for we ourselves are living once again in an age of Michael. We find one of these Michael streams, if we look back to the period immediately preceding that of the mystery of Golgotha, to the Arthur impulse going out from the West, from England, an impulse which was kindled originally by the Hibernian mysteries. And we find a still more ancient form of this Michael stream if we look back to what happened centuries before the mystery of Golgotha, when, taking its start from northern Greece in Macedonia, the international cosmopolitan stream, connected with the name of Alexander the Great, arose under the influence of the conception of the world that is known as the Aristotelian. What was achieved through Aristotle and Alexander in that pre-Christian age took place under the rulership of Michael, just as now, once again, we are living under his rulership. The Michael impulse was there in the spiritual life at the time of Alexander the Great, just as it is there now in our own time. Whenever a Michael impulse is at work in humanity upon the earth, it is always a time when that which has been founded in a center of spiritual culture spreads abroad among many peoples of the earth and is carried into many regions wherever it is possible to carry it. This came to pass in pre-Christian times through the campaigns of Alexander. The achievements of Greek culture were spread among men wherever this became possible. If one had asked Alexander and Aristotle, "Whence comes your impulse to spread abroad the spiritual culture of your age?" they would have spoken, though under a different name, of that same being, Michael, who works from the sun as the servant of Christ. For among the archangels, who in turn rule over civilization, Michael belongs to the sun. Michael was ruler in the time of Alexander, and is ruler again in our own time. The next ruling archangel was Orifiel, who belongs to Saturn. His successor, the archangel Anael, belongs to Venus, while Zechariel, the archangel who ruled civilization in the 4th and 5th centuries, belongs to the sphere of Jupiter. Then came Raphael from the Mercury sphere, at the time when a form of thought connected with medicine and healing lived in the background of European civilization. After Raphael came Samael, whose rulership extended a little beyond the 12th century. And then came the age of Gabriel. Samael belongs to Mars, Gabriel to the moon, and Gabriel was once again succeeded by Michael, who belongs to the sun sphere, in the 70s of the 19th century. Thus, in rhythmic succession, these 7 beings of the hierarchy of the archangels rule over the spiritual life of the earth. And so as we look back, when was the last rulership of Micaiah? It was in the Alexander period. It prevailed during that period when Greek civilization was carried across to Asia and Africa, and finally concentrated in the great and influential city of Alexandria with its mighty heroes of the spiritual life. It is a strange vista that presents itself to occult sight. In the age which lies a few centuries before the mystery of Golgotha, we see going eastward from Macedonia, that is to say, once more from west to east, but this time farther to the east, we see the same stream which proceeds from the English and Irish souls in the west, and which also flows from west to east. During the Alexander period, Michael was the ruling archangel on the earth. During the Arthur period, when Michael was working from the sun, the influences I have described were sent down from the sun. But what happened later on, after the mystery of Golgotha had taken place? What happened to the kind of thought that had been carried by Alexander the Great over to Asia? At the time when Charlemagne, in his own way, was establishing a certain form of Christian culture in Europe, Harun al-Rashid was living over yonder in Asia Minor. All the Oriental wisdom and spirituality to be found at that time, in architecture, in art, in science, in religion, in literature, in poetry, it was all gathered at the court of Harun al-Rashid. And at his side there was a counselor, a man who was not initiated in all these arts and sciences at that time, but who had been an initiate in earlier times, in a former life. Around these two men, Harun al-Rashid and his counselor, we find that all the wisdom which had been carried by Alexander into Asia, all the teachings which had been drawn from the old nature wisdom and were imparted by Aristotle to those he was able to instruct, all this was changed. Alexandrianism and Aristotelianism were permeated and impregnated at the court of Harun al-Rashid with Arabism, with Mohammedanism. And then all the learning thus permeated with Arabism was carried over into the stream of Christianity by way of Greece, but especially by way of northern Africa, Italy, and Spain. It was carried over, inculcated, as it were, into the world of Christendom. But before this, Harun al-Rashid and his counselor had passed through the gate of death. And from that life which leads from death to a new birth, they looked down on what was taking place on earth in the expeditions of the Mohammedan Moors to Spain. From the spiritual world, they watched the form of culture which they themselves had promoted and which had been spread by their successors. Harun al-Rashid concentrated his attention from the spiritual world more on the regions of Greece, Italy, and Spain. His counselor more on the stream going out from the east, across the regions to the north of the Black Sea, through Russia and into Central Europe. And now the question arises, what was the destiny of Alexander and Aristotle themselves? They were deeply bound up with the rulership of Micaiah, but they were not incarnated on the earth at the time of the mystery of Golgotha. We must try to get a clear conception of the two contrasting pictures. On the earth are those who were contemporaries of the mystery of Golgotha. Christ comes down through the mystery of Golgotha, becomes man, and from then on lives in the earth sphere. And what is happening on the sun? On the sun there are the souls who at that time belonged to Micaiah, who were living in his sphere. These souls witnessed from the sun the departure of Christ from the sun and his descent to earth. On the earth there were those who witnessed his arrival. That is the difference. The experience of those who were on earth during the Michael rulership at the time of Alexander was that they saw, as it were, the other direction of the Christ event, namely the departure of the Christ from the sun. They live on. I will not now mention unimportant incarnations, and they experience in the spiritual world that significant point of time in the 9th century, about the year 869, when there took place the meeting of the Christ with his own image, with his own life spirit brought over from pagan pre-Christian Christianity. Another meeting also took place in the spiritual world, a meeting of the individualities living in Alexander the Great and in Aristotle with the individualities who had lived in Harun al-Rashid and his counselor. The wisdom from Asia, in a Mohammedanized form, living in Harun al-Rashid and his counselor after their death, came into contrast in the spiritual world with Alexander and Aristotle. On the one side, Aristotelianism and Alexandrianism, but impregnated with Mohammedanism. And on the other, the real Aristotle and the real Alexander, not a weakened form of their teachings. Alexander and Aristotle had witnessed the mystery of Golgotha from the sun. Then a great spiritual exchange, a great heavenly council, if one may call it so, took place in the spiritual world between Mohammedanized Aristotelianism and Christianized Aristotelianism, which had, however, been imbued in the spiritual world with the Christian impulse. In the spiritual world, which borders on our physical earth, it was here that Alexander and Aristotle met with Harun al-Rashid and his counselor, and consulted together as to the further progress of Christianity in Europe, with an eye to what should come at the end of the 19th century and in the 20th century, when Michael would again have the rulership on earth. This all took place in the light raying from that other event, namely the meeting of Christ with his own image. That heavenly council was permeated by the influence of this meeting, and the lines, the threads of the spiritual life of humanity were projected with great intensity in the spiritual world which borders on the physical earth. Below in the earth itself, the Church Fathers gathered together in Constantinople at the 8th Ecumenical Council, where they formulated the dogma that man does not consist of body, soul, and spirit, but only of body and soul, the soul possessing certain spiritual attributes. Trichotomy, the definition of man as body, soul, and spirit, was done away with, and anyone who persisted in believing it was declared to be a heretic. The Christian fathers in Europe never spoke of body, soul, and spirit, but only of body and soul. The decisive event which took place in the year 869 in the supersensible worlds, as I have described it, cast its shadows down into the earthly world. The Dark Age, the Kali Yuga, received a special impetus, while what I have just described was taking place above, in the spiritual world. Such was the real course of events. In the physical world, the Council of Constantinople, which eliminated the spirit, and in the world immediately bordering on the physical, a heavenly council such as I have described, coinciding with the meeting of Christ himself with his own image. But it was known that it was a question of waiting until the new Michael age had dawned on earth. There were, nonetheless, always a few teachers who knew, even though in a somewhat decadent way, something of what takes place behind the veils of existence. There were always teachers who knew how to present, if not always in very apt pictures, the spiritual content of the world, who could speak of what was happening in the spiritual world that is so near to the earth. And here and there these teachers found ears willing to listen to them. Their listeners were men who learned something of true Christianity by catching here and there fragmentary words as to what would become in the 20th century, after the Michael rulership had begun once again. If in you yourselves, my dear friends, are the souls who were in incarnation at that time, and listened to those who spoke of the coming age of Michael, and whose speech was influenced by impulses coming down from the heavenly council of which I have told you. From these experiences of a previous life in the early Christian centuries, not precisely the 9th century, but before and after, chiefly before, arose the subconscious urge, when the Michael rulership should be there once more, from the end of the 19th century onward, to look for centers where the spiritual life is again cultivated under the influence of Michael. This impulse was rooted in the souls of those who had once heard of the teachings, who knew something of the mysteries of which we have spoken today. And so the karmic urge lives in souls to find their way to that form of Christianity which was to be spread by anthroposophy under the influence of Michael at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries. What these souls had experienced in earlier times expresses itself in this incarnation, in the fact that certain of them find their way to the anthroposophical movement. Knowledge resulting from a converging of old pre-Christian cosmic Christianity with inward Christian doctrines, teachings which were connected with the spiritual workings of nature, and yet also with the mystery of Golgotha, continued to be taught on earth at the time when those souls who now in this later incarnation feel themselves drawn to anthroposophy had passed through the gates of death and were living in the spiritual world between death and a new birth. Some of them indeed came down to incarnation on the earth. The ancient teachings, with their cosmic view of Christianity, lived on, propagating traditions of the mysteries of antiquity. This knowledge lived on in schools in Europe, like that of Chartres in the 12th century, with its great teachers, Bernardus Silvestris, Alanus ab Insulis, and others. And the teachings lived and worked, too, in the great teacher of Dante, Brunetto Latini, of whom I spoke to you in the last lecture. In this way we see how there is a continuation of the knowledge in which there was still connection between cosmic Christianity and the purely human, earthly Christianity, which more and more gained the supremacy on earth. The council held in Constantinople was an earthly shadow image of something that took place in the spiritual world. A constant connection was maintained between what was proceeding in the physical world and in the immediately adjacent spiritual world. And because of this, the most illustrious teachers of Chartres felt themselves inspired by the true Alexander and the true Aristotle, although in a still stronger way by Plato and by the Platonic and Neoplatonic thought which prevailed in the mysticism of the Middle Ages. Something of great significance now took place. Those who had grouped themselves around Michael and who had for the most part been incarnated at the time of Alexander were now living in the spiritual world. Looking down from thence, they saw how Christianity was evolving under the teachers of Chartres. But they waited until these teachers, who were the last who taught of Christianity in its cosmic aspect, they waited until these teachers of Chartres had come up into the spiritual world. And at a certain point of time, at the end of the 12th and beginning of the 13th centuries, there gathered together in the spiritual sphere bordering on our earth, the more definitely Platonic teachers of Chartres, and those who had in some way taken part in the Heavenly Council in the year 869. There took place, if I may use trivial words of earth to describe such a sublime event, a kind of conference between the teachers of Chartres who had just ascended into the spiritual world and were now to continue their existence there, and those who were on the point of descending to earth, among them the individualities of Alexander and Aristotle, who immediately afterward incarnated in the Dominican order. And then, in a body of teaching that is so misunderstood today, but the deep significance of which ought to be realized, in scholasticism, preparation was made for all that was to come later on in the next age of Michael. And now, in order that they might enter right into the heart of Christianity, the souls who belonged to the sphere of Michael, who had lived in the old Alexander time, who had not lived on earth during the first Christian centuries, or at least only in unimportant incarnations. These souls now came into incarnation in order to imbibe Christianity in the Dominican or other orders, but mainly in the Dominican order. Again they passed through the gate of death and continued their existence in the spiritual world. In the 15th century and lasting on into the 16th, and it must be remembered that time relationships are quite different in the spiritual world, there took place in the supersensible world the great process of instruction instituted by Michael himself for those who belonged to him. A great supersensible school was founded, a school in which Michael himself was the teacher, and in which those souls took part who had been inspired by the impulses of the Alexander age, and had later steeped themselves in Christianity in the manner described. All the discarnate souls who belonged to Michael took part in this great school in the supersensible world during the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries. All the beings of the hierarchy of angels, archangels, and archai who belonged to the Michael stream, as well as many elementary beings, also took part in it. In this supersensible school, a wonderful review was given of the wisdom of the ancient mysteries. Detailed knowledge in regard to the ancient mysteries was imparted to the souls partaking in this school. They looked back to the sun mysteries, to the mysteries of the other planets. But a vista of the future was given too, a vista of what should begin at the end of the 19th century in the new age of Michael. All this passed through these souls, who now in the present Michael age feel drawn to the anthroposophical movement. Meanwhile, on earth, the last bout of the struggle was taking place. Harun al-Rashid had incarnated again as Lord Bacon of Verulam, and in this new incarnation had set the impulse of materialism on foot. The universality of the teachings of Bacon, but also his materialism, came from his incarnation as Harun al-Rashid. Bacon was the reincarnated Harun al-Rashid. The counselor, who had taken the other path, incarnated in the same epoch as Amos Comenius. And so, while Christianity, illumined by Aristotelian and Alexandrian thought, was going through its most important phase of development in the supersensible worlds during the 14th, 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, during this very same period, we find materialism being established on earth in the minds of men, established in science by Bacon, the reincarnated Harun al-Rashid, and in the realm of education by Amos Comenius, the reincarnated counselor of Harun al-Rashid. The two souls worked together. When Amos Comenius and Bacon had once again passed through the gate of death, a remarkable thing came to pass in the spiritual world. After Bacon had passed through the gate of death, it happened that because of the particular mode of thinking he had adopted in his incarnation as Bacon, a whole world of idols, demonic idols, went forth from his etheric body and spread themselves out in the spiritual world, which was peopled by those who were the pupils of Michael. As I have shown in my first mystery play, things that happen on earth work powerfully into the spiritual world. Bacon's mode of thinking on the earth worked so shatteringly into the spiritual world that it was flooded by a whole host of, in quotes, idols. And the materialistic form of educational science, inaugurated by Amos Comenius, provided the sphere, the cosmic atmosphere, as it were, for the idols of Bacon. Bacon provided the idols. And just as we human beings have around us the mineral and plant kingdoms, so these idols of Bacon were surrounded by other kingdoms, which were necessary to their existence. And these were provided by what Amos Comenius had instituted on earth. The individualities who had once lived on the earth as Alexander and Aristotle set themselves to fight these demonic idols. And the conflict continued until the time when the French Revolution broke out on the earth. The idols, the demonic idols, which it had not been possible to overcome, which had, as it were, escaped from the fight, descended to earth and became the inspiring forces of the materialism of the 19th century with its many consequences. These forces are the inspirers of the materialism of the 19th century. The souls who had remained behind, who, with the assistance of the individualities of Aristotle and Alexander, had profited by the teaching of Michael, came back to earth, bearing the impulses I have described, toward the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. And many of these souls can be recognized in those who come to the anthroposophical movement. Such is the karma of those who come to the movement with inner sincerity. It is a shattering experience to hear of what is happening immediately behind the events in the outer world at the present time. But it is something which, under the impulse of the Christmas Foundation at the Gertianum, must be implanted in the hearts and souls of those who call themselves anthroposophists. It must live in their hearts and souls, and it will give them the strength to work on. For those who are anthroposophists today, in the true sense, will feel a strong urge to come down again to the earth very soon. And with a faculty of prophecy connected with a Michael impulse, it can be foreseen that many anthroposophical souls will come again to the earth at the end of the 20th century in order to bring to full realization the anthroposophical movement, which must now be established on a firm and sure foundation. Every anthroposophist should be moved by this knowledge. Quote, "I have in me the impulse of anthroposophy. I recognize it as the Michael impulse. I wait and am strengthened in my waiting by true activity in anthroposophy at the present time, in order that after the short interval allotted in the 20th century to anthroposophical souls between death and a new birth, I may come again at the end of the century to promote the movement with much more spiritual power. I am preparing for the new age, leading from the 20th into the 21st century." Close quote. It is thus that a true anthroposophist speaks. Many forces of destruction are at work upon the earth. All culture, all civilized life must fall into decadence if the spirituality of the Michael impulse does not so lay hold of men that they are capable of bringing upliftment to the civilization that is hurrying downhill. If there are to be found truly anthroposophical souls, willing to bring this spirituality into earthly life, then there will be a movement leading upward. If such souls are not found, decadence will continue to spread. The great war, with all its attendant evils, will be merely the beginning of still worse evils. Human beings today are facing a great crisis. Either they must see civilization going down into the abyss, or they must raise it by spirituality and promote it in the sense of the Michael impulse. That, my dear friends, is what I had to say to you on this occasion, and my desire is that it shall work on and bear fruit in your souls. For as I have often said at the conclusion of a happy and satisfying visit, when we have worked together for a time, we know as anthroposophists that it is our karma to have been able to do so. We know, too, that we still remain united, even when divided in physical space. We shall remain united in the signs that can reveal themselves to the eyes of spirit and to the ears of soul, if what I have said in these lectures has been received in full earnestness and has been understood. That is the end of Lecture 6, which is chronologically Lecture 70.